When the lights go out, they speak. The vanished, the cursed, the cruel. Their echoes live here. I'm Raven Vale, and you've just crossed the threshold. Welcome to Whispers from the Dark. Kope, welcome to Whispers from the Dark. Tonight's episode, The Last Call in the Dark. What happened to Brandon Lawson? There is something different about a voice when it knows something is wrong. Not panic, exactly. Panic is loud. Panic is readable. What comes through in certain recordings, the ones that get studied and replayed and argued over for years, is something harder to name. Something that operates below the register of ordinary distress. A quality of urgency that sits beneath the words rather than inside them. A pressure in the voice that communicates something the words themselves cannot quite carry. You hear it, and something in you responds before your mind has processed what was said. Because the body understands certain signals before the brain catches up. And the signal in the voice of Brandon Lawson, in the final recording anyone has of him speaking, is one that has unsettled everyone who has ever heard it. On the night of August 8th, 2013, a 26-year-old man from San Angelo, Texas, left his home after an argument with his girlfriend, Ledessa. He got into his truck and drove out into the dark. Not toward anything specific. Just away. The way people do when the walls of a situation close in and movement feels like the only available answer. He had 4 children. He had a history of health struggles, including a blood clotting disorder that required regular medication he had not taken consistently in the days leading up to that night. He had a relationship under strain. He had a life that was, by most accounts, under a particular kind of quiet pressure that doesn't always announce itself clearly until something breaks. Brandon Lawson was, by every account from the people who knew him, a man who was trying. Trying to be a father. Trying to manage a difficult health situation without the kind of support structure that makes that manageable. Trying to hold together a life that had more strain running through it than was always visible on the outside. That context matters. Not because it explains what happened, but because it tells you that the man who drove out of San Angelo that night was not a mystery before he became one. He was a person. Specific, complicated, real. The kind of person whose disappearance leaves a particular shape of absence behind. An absence that has a voice in it because we have a recording, and has a face in it because his family has kept it visible, and has a question in it that more than a decade has not answered. He drove west out of San Angelo on State Highway 277, heading toward Abilene, on a route that cuts through the flat, spare landscape of West Texas. The kind of country where the dark is absolute. Where the nearest light is miles away. Where the only sounds at 2 in the morning are the road and the wind and the specific silence of land with nothing on it. The land out there doesn't offer comfort. It offers exposure. It is the kind of landscape that makes a person aware of how small they are, how far from anything, how quickly a situation can move from manageable to something else, entirely. At some point on that highway, his truck ran out of gas. He pulled over somewhere in the stretch between San Angelo and the small town of Bronte. Stranded. Alone, on a road that carried almost no traffic at that hour. The kind of place where you become acutely aware of how far you are from anything. He made two phone calls. The first was to his brother Kyle, who lived in the area. He told Kyle he was out of gas, told him where he was, and asked him to come. Kyle later said that Brandon's voice sounded off, not just tired or frustrated, something more than that, rushed, distracted, like he was paying attention to more than one thing at the same time, like part of his attention was somewhere else, somewhere behind him, or around him, or in a direction Kyle couldn't see from the other end of the phone. Kyle got in his car and headed toward his brother. The second call was to 911, and that call is where the story stops being something with an explanation. The call was logged at approximately 12:57 in the morning. It lasted 1 minute and 49 seconds. In recorded human distress, that is not a very long time. But the recording of those 109 seconds has been listened to hundreds of thousands of times by people who have never met Brandon Lawson, who have no personal stake in the outcome, who simply cannot let it go. Because something in it doesn't resolve. Something in it sits wrong in the mind and will not be filed away. The dispatcher who answered heard a male voice, urgent and broken, attempting to communicate something that kept slipping out of reach. The call begins with Brandon identifying himself by first name and attempting to give his location. So far, normal. A man on the side of a road, out of gas, calling for assistance. But within the first few seconds, something shifts. His words begin to fragment, to overlap, to arrive in bursts separated by breathing that sounds like effort rather than exertion. He says he is in the middle of a field. He says he got chased into the woods. He says there are people out there. He says they are after him. The dispatcher tries to anchor the conversation, asks for a location, asks him to slow down, asks what is happening. Brandon keeps talking, but the information does not accumulate the way information in a functional emergency call accumulates. It circles, it backtracks, it points in directions that don't connect. There is a reference to needing police. There is a reference to people bleeding. There is something about a guy being passed out. There is a sense throughout the call of a man who is looking at something, or away from something, and trying simultaneously to describe it and respond to it. A person whose attention is divided in a way that makes sequential communication nearly impossible. Whether that divided attention was caused by something external and dangerous, or by something occurring inside Brandon's own body and mind, is the question that has never been answered. There is an urgency that feels completely genuine, and a narrative that completely refuses to cohere. And then the call ends, not with Brandon hanging up, not with a clear goodbye or a statement of intent. It ends the way certain things end. In the middle. Without resolution. Without the next sentence. As if the transmission simply stopped. Kyle arrived at the location to find Brandon's truck exactly as described. Parked on the shoulder of Highway 277. Both doors open. The engine off. No sign of Brandon. Kyle searched the immediate area, called his brother's name into the dark. Got nothing back. He called Brandon's cell phone. It rang, somewhere in the direction of the brush off the shoulder of the road. But no one answered. And that detail, the phone ringing in the dark, audible but unreachable, close enough to locate by sound, and too far or too obscured to find, is one of the details that stays. Because it means Brandon was there, or had been there very recently. It means the phone was on. It means Brandon was not. Kyle contacted law enforcement. Officers arrived and expanded the search. They went into the fields and brush off the highway. They called out. They looked for signs of movement, of disturbance, of any physical trace of a 26-year-old man who had been standing in this exact location less than an hour earlier. They found nothing. No footprints they could follow to a conclusion. No evidence of a struggle. No blood. No clothing. No indication of where Brandon Lawson had gone, or why, or with whom. He was simply not there. In the days that followed, searches were organized. Family members combed the terrain. Law enforcement conducted additional sweeps. The media picked up the story. And nothing was found. Brandon Lawson was gone. And the only record of his final known moments of communication was a phone call that raised more questions than it answered. That call would become, in the years following, one of the most analyzed pieces of audio in missing persons history. Thousands of hours of collective attention from people who had never heard of Bronte, Texas, who could not have pointed to Highway 277 on a map, who found themselves returning to those 109 seconds again and again because they could not locate the answer that the recording seemed to be about to provide. Something happened on that highway, something that Brandon Lawson was attempting to describe in real time while it was happening to him. And he was never able to finish the description, and no one has been able to finish it for him, to understand why the 911 call has held so many people for so long. You have to understand what it actually sounds like to listen to it. Not a transcript of it. Not a description of it. The audio itself. Because transcripts and descriptions flatten the thing that makes it so difficult to dismiss. When you read the words, they can be organized into two or three possible explanations without too much trouble. When you hear the voice behind them, something resists organization. The quality of Brandon's breathing, the specific rhythm of interruption in his speech, the moments where he seems to be responding to something happening in real time, turning his attention away from the phone toward whatever is around him before returning to the dispatcher. These are things that exist in the recording and not on any page. People who have studied the audio extensively, amateur investigators, families of other missing persons who recognized something in it, forensic audio analysts attempting to clean up and enhance the quality, have come away with different conclusions, but almost none of them have come away dismissing it. The first major question is the most fundamental one. Was Brandon describing something real that was happening around him? Or was he describing something that was not there? Those are not equally valued questions in public conversation about this case. The more dramatic version, that Brandon encountered something or someone dangerous on that highway, that he was pursued, that there were other people involved, that something violent or criminal occurred in those fields off Highway 277, gets more attention. It is the version that generates the most engagement, the most theories, the most detailed speculation. But the second version deserves equal serious consideration. And it is this. By the night of August 8th, 2013, Brandon Lawson had not taken his prescribed blood thinners consistently. He had been under significant stress. He had left home in the middle of the night after an argument. He was alone on a dark highway, at 1 in the morning, and the symptoms of several medical conditions, including certain presentations related to blood clotting issues that affect cerebral circulation, can include sudden confusion, paranoia, difficulty speaking coherently, and the experience of threat that feels entirely real from the inside, regardless of external reality. This is not a dismissal of Brandon. It is not an attempt to explain away what happened with a comfortable label. It is a recognition that the human brain, under certain conditions of physiological crisis, can generate an experience of danger that is indistinguishable from genuine external threat, while simultaneously impairing the ability to communicate what is happening in a way that others can follow. The dispatcher on that call was trying to reach someone. Brandon was trying to reach back, and somewhere between them, the transmission kept breaking down. Not because of the phone connection, because whatever was happening to Brandon in those moments, whether external, internal, or some combination, was beyond his ability to translate into sequential, communicable language. He knew something was wrong. The knowing was completely real. The communication of it was fractured beyond repair. And that fracture is precisely what has kept this case suspended in the space between resolution and mystery for over a decade. Kyle Lawson, Brandon's brother, has been one of the most persistent and vocal advocates for continued investigation of his brother's disappearance. He has spoken publicly about the case, engaged with the online communities that have formed around it, pushed back on theories he considers disrespectful to his brother's memory, and maintained, consistently, that he believes something happened to Brandon out there. That there was a real threat, a real encounter, a real reason for Brandon to have run from the road into the brush in the middle of the night. Kyle's conviction deserves respect. He knew his brother. He heard his brother's voice on the phone earlier that night and recognized something in it that concerned him enough to get in the car immediately. He arrived at that scene and searched it himself in the dark, calling his brother's name into terrain that gave nothing back. He has lived in the absence of answers for more than a decade. His certainty that something happened to Brandon is not speculation. It is the conviction of a person who was present, who knew the person who disappeared, and who has had to live every day inside the question of what became of his brother. There is a particular loneliness in that position that is hard to fully convey from the outside. When someone dies, the grief has a known shape. It is devastating, but it is a known devastation. The community around you understands what you need and what you are going through. But when someone disappears without explanation, the grief has no known shape. It cannot fully form because it has no confirmed object. The people around you don't know whether to grieve with you or hope with you, and you yourself cannot decide from one day to the next which one is the appropriate response. So you carry both the weight of mourning and the weight of not knowing simultaneously. For over 10 years, the investigators who worked the initial case and the searches that followed have confirmed that despite extensive searching of the terrain near the highway, no remains were found in the immediate aftermath of Brandon's disappearance. The brush and fields off Highway 277 in that area are dense enough and remote enough that the absence of immediate discovery doesn't rule out the presence of something. West Texas terrain is not forgiving to searches conducted at night or in the days following, when conditions and the extent of the search area make comprehensive coverage extremely difficult. The land in that corridor is characterized by scrub brush, uneven ground, areas of low visibility even in daylight, and the kind of topography that can obscure something completely from a search team moving through it on foot. What the official record offers is this: a truck, a 911 call, an absence. No confirmed witness to what happened after Brandon left the road. No physical evidence that has been publicly confirmed as conclusively connected to his fate. No body. No person of interest identified by law enforcement. No arrest. No explanation that any official body has committed to. More than a decade after Brandon Lawson walked into the dark off-highway 277 and didn't come back, his case remains officially classified as a missing persons case rather than a homicide investigation, though that classification is a function of the absence of evidence rather than a statement about what occurred. You cannot officially declare a crime without evidence of a crime, and evidence in this case has been extraordinarily unwilling to surface. There is a dimension to this case that the online communities who have followed it closely have developed into something substantial enough to warrant attention, even from people who are generally skeptical of amateur investigation. The 911 audio has been analyzed at a level of technical detail that most recordings of this kind never receive. People with audio engineering backgrounds have isolated tracks, adjusted frequencies, removed background noise, and attempted to surface words or sounds that the original recording obscures. Some of these enhanced versions have surfaced details that are themselves disputed, fragments that some listeners hear as additional voices, sounds that some interpret as movement or struggle, phrases beneath the primary audio that some believe contain information Brandon was attempting to communicate. None of this analysis is conclusive. The enhanced audio is not admissible evidence. The interpretations of what various listeners hear vary widely enough that the same enhanced clip has been cited as support for directly contradictory theories. But the sheer volume of attention that has been directed at this recording by people with no personal connection to the case speaks to something real about the quality of the original. There is something in it, something that transmits through compression and enhancement and years of degradation, something that sounds, to every person who has listened without a predetermined conclusion, like a man encountering something he did not expect, something he could not name clearly enough for anyone to help him with, something that was happening right then, in real time, on a dark stretch of Texas highway, while the dispatcher asked questions, and Kyle drove as fast as he could, and the night got quieter and quieter, and the call simply stopped. There is also the matter of what was not found. Brandon Lawson's cell phone was not recovered. His personal effects were not found in the surrounding area. The terrain was searched, and searched again, and at no point in the years following his disappearance has any confirmed physical trace of him been officially identified and connected to a location that would answer the central question of where he went. In cases of this kind, a person who disappears from a known location in a relatively contained area with no confirmed sighting afterward, the absence of physical evidence over an extended period can mean several things. It can mean the terrain has not been searched in the right place. It can mean the remains were moved. It can mean something occurred that left no conventional trail. Or it can mean something that happens in a small number of cases that are never resolved, that a set of circumstances aligned in a way that removed a person from the visible world without leaving behind the markers we typically rely on to reconstruct what happened. Brandon Lawson's family does not have those markers. They have a truck, they have a phone call, they have a voice, and they have the weight of not knowing, which is a particular kind of burden that sits differently from grief. Because grief, as devastating as it is, has a shape. It has a known object. Not knowing is formless. It presses from every direction. It has no clear boundary and no clear end. And for Kyle, for Ladessa, for Brandon's four children, who are now years older than the night their father drove away, that formlessness has been the constant companion of more than a decade. Let's sit with the theories. Not to rank them or dismiss any of them, but to understand what each one requires us to believe, and what evidence each one would need to be supported. Because theories in cases like this are not idle speculation. They are the framework through which a family tries to understand what happened to someone they love, and they deserve to be treated with the seriousness that reflects. The first theory is foul play, that Brandon encountered one or more individuals on or near Highway 277 that night, that those individuals posed a genuine threat, that what Brandon was describing on the 911 call, people in the field, people after him, someone bleeding, was an accurate account of real people in a real confrontation. That he ran from the road because running was the correct response to what was happening. And that whatever happened in that brush, in those fields, in the dark off the shoulder of a highway in West Texas, at 1 a.m, it ended in a way that left no trace, no witness, and no body in the places that were searched. This theory requires believing that Brandon's account of events, fragmented as it was, contained accurate external information. It requires believing that individuals capable of whatever they are alleged to have done were also capable of leaving no evidence in the area. And it requires accepting that nearly 12 years of searching have failed to surface remains or evidence simply because the right location has not yet been identified. None of those requirements are impossible. Remote terrain keeps secrets. People do encounter others in isolated places at night. Violence does occasionally occur in circumstances that produce no immediate physical evidence in the searched area. The theory cannot be ruled out. And for Brandon's family, it cannot be set aside, because it is the version of events in which Brandon did everything right, recognized a threat, called for help, tried to run, and was failed by circumstances beyond his control rather than undone by something internal. The second theory centers on medical crisis. Brandon's blood clotting disorder, the condition for which he was prescribed medication he had not been consistently taking, is known to carry neurological risks when unmanaged. Blood clots can form in the brain or disrupt cerebral circulation in ways that produce sudden, dramatic changes in cognition and perception. A person experiencing a neurological event of this kind might find themselves genuinely confused about their location, genuinely frightened by perceptions that do not match external reality, and genuinely unable to communicate what is happening in a way that others can follow. The fragmented quality of the 911 call, the way Brandon's account keeps circling rather than building, the way he seems to be describing a coherent experience that doesn't translate, is consistent with this. So is the decision to leave the vehicle and move into the brush, which is not the behavior of someone thinking clearly about their situation. Under this theory, Brandon walked into the terrain off the highway in a state of severe confusion possibly collapsed, and was not found in the initial search, simply because search conditions at night in dense brush on uneven terrain are genuinely limited. The absence of remains would then require either that the initial searches missed the location, possible given the terrain, or that other factors affected what remained to be found over the months and years that followed. This theory does not require believing that Brandon did anything wrong. It requires believing that his body failed him in a moment when he was already vulnerable, alone, and far from the help that might have reached him in time. The third category of theory is the one that lives at the outer edge of serious consideration, the territory of the unknown and the unexplained. West Texas has a history of reports that don't fit conventional frameworks. People who follow cases in this region have noted patterns of disappearances along certain corridors that have not produced conventional explanations. This is not evidence. It is a pattern noticed by people looking for patterns, which is a very different thing. The human mind is extraordinarily good at finding patterns, and it finds them in random data as readily as in meaningful data. But the existence of these observations is worth noting, not because they explain Brandon's disappearance, but because they reflect something genuine about the experience of certain landscapes, the experience of being somewhere that feels as though ordinary rules are suspended. That West Texas highway at 1 a.m, in the dark, with the wind moving across flat ground and nothing visible in any direction, is the kind of place that can make the ordinary feel strange. Whatever happened to Brandon Lawson, it happened in a place that was not designed to give up its secrets easily. What the 911 call actually tells us, if we listen to it stripped of the frameworks we bring to it, is limited but real. It tells us that Brandon Lawson was frightened. It tells us that his fear had a source, something he was experiencing that felt urgent and immediate and threatening. It tells us that he was trying, with everything available to him in that moment, to communicate what was happening. And it tells us that the communication failed. Not because Brandon didn't try. Not because the dispatcher didn't try. But because something about the gap between what Brandon was experiencing and what could be transmitted through a phone call on a rural highway in the middle of the night was too wide to bridge in 1:49. That failure, the failure of communication at the exact moment when communication was most needed, is the thing that sits in the center of this case and refuses to leave. There is a version of this story in which everything Brandon described was real and external, and he was failed by circumstances. There is a version in which his mind and body produced something that felt identical to external reality from the inside, and he was failed by circumstance. And there is, as there always is in cases that remain unresolved, the possibility that the version that actually happened is one we haven't yet been able to fully imagine, because the cases that go unsolved are not always the ones where the answer is most hidden. Sometimes they are the ones where the answer is so specific, so contingent on a particular combination of time and place and circumstance, that no general framework accommodates it cleanly. Brandon Lawson does not fit cleanly. He was a real person who drove out into a Texas night and made a phone call that the world has been trying to decode ever since. He was a father. He was a brother. He was 26 years old. And wherever he is, in whatever form the answer to this case eventually takes, his family is still waiting for the version of the story that ends with understanding rather than question marks. They have been waiting for over a decade. The 911 call is still there, still playing, still asking the question it has always been asking, not what happened, but whether anyone will ever be close enough, careful enough, lucky enough to hear the answer in it. And whether the darkness that absorbed Brandon Lawson on Highway 277 is the kind that eventually gives something back, or the kind that simply keeps. Think about what it means to ask for help in a moment of genuine crisis and have the words fail you. To know what you're trying to say and be unable to make it land. To hear the voice on the other end trying to understand and feel the gap between you widen with every attempted sentence. That is not a hypothetical experience. For certain medical emergencies, for certain states of extreme fear or confusion, that gap is real. The person experiencing it is not less present because they are harder to reach. They are not less real because their communication is fragmented. They are simply beyond the reach of the tools available in that moment. And the tragedy of the Brandon Lawson case, one of its many tragedies, is that help was close. Kyle was driving toward him. Law enforcement was on the way. People were coming. And whatever was happening to Brandon in those fields was happening faster than the distance could close. In the dark. In the silence. In the space between a voice calling out and the hands that were almost there to receive it. Some calls for help are answered too late. Some are answered by the wrong people. And some arrive in a form so broken by circumstance that no one who receives them can fully understand what is being asked. Brandon Lawson made a call. He asked for something. He tried with everything he had in that moment to tell someone where he was and what was happening. And the call was received. The dispatcher heard him. Kyle heard him. Law enforcement heard him. His family has been hearing him ever since, replaying those 109 seconds looking for the detail that makes it make sense. We are still not entirely sure what he was asking. And the not knowing, for his family, for everyone who has ever pressed play on that audio and listened closely, is a kind of darkness that has no clean edge. No moment where it clearly ends. Just a voice, fading into West Texas, in the middle of a night that never fully resolved. This has been Whispers from the Dark. I'm Raven Vale, and some questions don't have answers. They just have the sound of a voice that tried to give you one before the dark took it.